Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Amina by Edward Lucas White. Waldo brought face to face with the actuality of the unbelievable, as he himself would have worded it, was completely dazed. In silence he suffered a counsel to lead him from the tepid gloom of the interior, through the ruinous doorway, out into the hot, stunning brilliance of the desert landscape. Hassan followed, with never a look behind him. Without any word, he had taken Waldo's gun from his nerveless hand and carried it, with his own and the counsel's. The counsel strode across the gravelly sand, some 50 paces from the southwest corner of the tomb, to a bit of no wholly ruined wall from which there was a clear view of the doorway, side of the tomb, and of the side with the larger crevice. "Hassan," he commanded, "watch here." Hassan said something in Persian. "How many cubs were there?" the consul asked Waldo. Waldo stared mute. "How many young ones did you see?" the consul asked again. 20 or more," Waldo made answer. "That's impossible," snapped the consul. "There seemed to be 16 or 18," Waldo reasserted. Hassan smiled and grunted. The consul took from him two guns, handed Waldo his, and they walked around the tomb to a point about equally distant from the opposite corner. There was another bit of ruin, and in front of it, on the side toward the tomb, was a block of stone, mostly in the shadow of the wall. "Convenient," said the consul. "Sit on that stone and lean against the wall. Make yourself comfortable. You're a bit shaken, but you will be all right in a moment. You should have something to eat, but we have nothing. Anyhow, take a good swallow of this." He stood by him as Waldo gasped over the raw brandy. "Hassan will bring you his water bottle before he goes," the consul went on. "Drink plenty, for you must stay here for some time. And now, pay attention to me. We must extirpate these vermin. The male, I judge, is absent. If he had been anywhere about, you would not now be alive. The young cannot be as many as you say, but I take it we have to deal with 10, a full litter. You must smoke them out. Hassan will go back to camp after fuel and the guard. Meanwhile, you and I must see that none escape." He took Waldo's gun, opened the breech, shut it, examined the magazine, and handed it back to him. "Now watch me closely," he said. He paced off, looking to his left past the tomb. Presently he stopped and gathered several stones together. "You see these?" he called. Waldo shouted an affirmation. The consul came back, passed on in the same line, looking to his right past the tomb, and presently at a similar distance put up another tiny cairn, shouted again, and was again answered. Again he returned. "Now, you are sure you cannot mistake those two marks I have made?" "Very sure indeed," said Waldo. "It is important," warned the consul. "I am going back to where I left Hassan, to watch there while he is gone. You will watch here. You may pace as often as you like to either of those stone heaps. From either you can see me on my beat. Do not diverge from the line from one to the other. For as soon as Hassan is out of sight, I shall shoot any moving thing I see nearer. Sit here till you see me set up similar limits for my sentry go on the further side. Then shoot any moving thing not on my line of patrol. Keep a lookout all around you. There is one chance in a million that the male might return in daylight. Mostly they are nocturnal, but this lair is evidently exceptional. Keep a bright lookout. And now listen to me. You must not feel any foolish sentimentalism about any fancied resemblance of these vermin to human beings. Shoot, and shoot to kill. Not only is it our duty, in general, to abolish them, but it will be very dangerous for us if we do not. There is little or no solidarity in Mohammedan communities, but On the comparatively few points upon which public opinion exists, it acts with amazing promptitude and vigor. One matter as to which there is no disagreement is that it is incumbent upon every man to assist in eradicating these creatures. The good old biblical custom of stoning to death is the mode of lynching indigenous hereabouts. These modern Asiatics are quite capable of applying it to anyone believed derelict against any of these inimical monsters. If we let one escape and the rumor of it gets about, we may precipitate an outburst of racial prejudice difficult to cope with. Shoot, I say, without hesitation or mercy. I understand, said Waldo. I don't care whether you understand or not, said the council. I want you to act. Shoot, if needful, and shoot straight. And he tramped off. Hassan presently appeared, and Waldo drank from his water bottle as nearly all of its contents as Hassan would permit. After his departure, Waldo's first alertness soon gave place to mere endurance of the monotony of watching and the intensity of the heat. His discomfort became suffering, and what with the fury of the dry glare, the pangs of thirst, and his bewilderment of mind, Waldo was moving in a waking dream by the time Hassan returned with two donkeys and a mule laden with brushwood. Behind the beast draggled the guard. Waldo's trance became a nightmare when the smoke took effect and the battle began. He was, however, not only required to join in the killing, but was enjoined to keep back. He did keep very much in the background, seeing only so much of the slaughter as his curiosity would not let him refrain from viewing. Yet he felt all the murderer as he gazed at the 10 small carcasses laid out now in the memory of his vigil and its end, indeed, of the whole day, though it was the day of his most marvelous adventure, remains to him as the broken recollections of phantasmagoria. On the morning of his memorable peril, Waldo had waked early. The experiences of his sea voyage, the sights at Gibraltar, at Port Said, in the canal at Suez, at Aden, at Muscat, and at Basra, have formed an altogether inadequate transition from the decorous regularity of house and school life in New England to the breathless wonder of the desert immensities. Everything seemed unreal, and yet the reality of its strangeness so besieged him that he could not feel at home in it. He could not sleep heavily in a tent. After composing himself to sleep, he lay long conscious and awakened early, as on this morning, just at the beginning of the false dawn. The council was fast asleep, snoring loudly. Waldo dressed quietly, went out, mechanically, without any purpose or forethought, taking his gun. Outside he found Hassan, seated, his gun across his knees, his head sunk forward, as fast asleep as the consul. Ali and Ibrahim had left the camp the days before for supplies. Waldo was the only waking creature about, for the guards, camped some little distance off, were but logs about the ashes of their fire. When he had begun camp life, he had expected to find the council, that combination of sportsman, explorer, and archaeologist, a particularly easygoing guardian. He looked forward to absolutely untrammeled liberty in the spacious expanse of the limitless waste. The reality he had found exactly the reverse of his preconceptions. The council's first injunction was, "Never let yourself get out of sight of me or of Hassan unless he or I send you off with Ali or Ibrahim. Let nothing tempt you to roam about alone. Even a ramble is dangerous. You might lose sight of the camp before you knew it." At first, Waldo agreed. Later, he protested. "I have a good pocket compass. I know how to use it. I never lost my way in the Maine woods." "No cords in the Maine woods," said the council. Yet before long, Waldo noticed that the few cords they encountered seemed simple-hearted, peaceful folk. No semblance of danger, even of adventure, had appeared. Their armed guard of a dozen greasy, tattered Damalians had passed their time in uneasy loafing. Likewise, Waldo noticed that the council seemed indifferent to the ruins they passed by or encamped among, that his feeling for sights and topography was cooler than lukewarm, that he showed no ardor in the pursuit of the scanty and uninteresting game. He had picked up enough of several dialects to hear repeated conversations about them. "Have you heard of any about here? Has one been killed? Any traces of them in this district?" And such queries he could make out in the various talks with the natives they met. As to what they were, he received no enlightenment. Then he had questioned Hassan as to why he was so restricted in his movements. Hassan spoke some English and regaled him with tales of afreets, ghouls, specters, and other uncanny legendary presences of the Djinn of the Waste, appearing in human shape, taking all languages, ever on the alert to ensnare infidels, of the woman whose feet turned the wrong way at the ankles, luring the unwary to a pool near drowning her victims, of the malignant ghost of dead brigands, more terrible than their living fellows, the spirit in the shape of a wild ass, or of a gazelle enticing its pursuers to the brink of a precipice, and itself seeming to run ahead upon an expanse of sand, a mere mirage, dissolving as the victim passed the brink and fell to death, of the sprite in the semblance of a hare feigning a limp, or of a ground bird feigning a broken wing, drawing its pursuer after it till he met his death in an unseen pit or well shaft. Ali and Ibrahim spoke no English. As far as Waldo could understand their long harangues, they told similar stories or hinted at dangers equally vague and imaginary. These childish boogie tales merely whetted Waldo's craving for independence. Now as he sat on a rock, longing to enjoy the perfect sky, the clear early air, the wide lonely landscape, along with a sense of having it to himself, it seemed to him that the council was merely innately cautious, overcautious. There was no danger. He would have a fine leisurely stroll, kill something perhaps, and certainly be back in camp before the sun grew hot. He stood up. Some hours later he was seated on a fallen coping stone in the shadow of a ruined tomb. All the country they had been traversing is full of tombs and remains of tombs, prehistoric, Bactrian, Old Persian, Parthian, Sassanian, or Mahometan, scattered everywhere in groups or solitary. Vanished utterly are the faintest traces of the cities, towns and villages, ephemeral houses, or temporary huts in which had lived the countless generations of mourners who had reared these tombs. The tombs, built more durably than mere dwellings of the living, remained. Complete or ruinous or reduced to mere fragments, they were everywhere. In that district, they were all of one type. Each was domed and below was square, its one door facing eastward and opening into a larger empty room, which were the mortuary chambers. The shadow of such a tomb, Waldo sat. He had shot nothing, had lost his way, had no idea of the direction of the camp, was tired, warm, and thirsty. He had forgotten his water bottle. He swept his gaze over the vast, desolate prospect. The unvaried turquoise of the sky arched above the rolling desert. Far reddish hills along the skyline, hooped in the less distant brown hillocks, which, without diversifying it, hummocked the yellow landscape. Sand and rocks with a lean, starved bush or two made up the nearer view, broken here and there by dazzling white or streaked grayish crumbling ruins. The sun had not been long above the horizon, yet the whole surface of the desert was quivering with heat. As Waldo sat viewing the outlook, a woman came around the corner tomb. All the village women Waldo had seen had worn yashmaks, or had some other form of face covering or veil. This woman was bareheaded and unveiled. She wore some sort of yellowish-brown garment which enveloped from neck to ankles, showing no waistline. Her feet, in defiance of the blistering sands, were bare. At sight of Waldo, she stopped and stared at him as he at her. He remarked the un-European posture of her feet, not at all turned out, but with the inner lines parallel. She wore no anklets, he observed no bracelets, no necklace or earrings. Her bare arms, he thought, the most muscular he had ever seen on a human being. Her nails were pointed and long, both on her hands and her feet. Her hair was black, short, and tousled, yet she did not look wild or uncomely. Her eyes smiled, and her lips had the effect of smiling, though they did not part ever so little, not showing at all the teeth behind them. "What a pity," said Waldo aloud, "that she does not speak English." "I do speak English," said the woman, and Waldo noticed that as she spoke her lips did not perceptibly open. "What does the gentleman want?" "You speak English," Waldo exclaimed, jumping to his feet. "What luck! Where did you learn it?" "At the mission school," she replied, an amused smile playing about the corners of her rather wide, unopening mouth. "What can be done for you?" She spoke with scarcely any foreign accent, but very slowly and with a sort of growl running along from syllable to syllable. "I am thirsty," said Waldo, "and I have lost my way." "Is a gentleman living in a brown tent, shaped like half a melon?" she inquired, the queer rumbling note drawling from one word to the other, her lips barely separated. "Yes, that is our camp," said Waldo. "I could guide the gentleman that way," she droned, "but it is far, and there is no water on that side." I want water first, said Waldo, or milk. If you mean cow's milk, we have none. But we have goat's milk. There's to drink where I dwell, she said, sing-songing the words. It is not far. It is the other way. Show me, said he. She began to walk, Waldo, his gun under his arm, beside her. She trod noiselessly and fast. Waldo could scarcely keep up with her. As they walked, he often fell behind and noted how her swathing garments clung to a lithe, shapely back, neat waist, and firm hips. Each time he hurried and caught up with her, he scanned her with intermittent glances, puzzled that her waist, so well marked at the spine, showed no particular definition in front, that the outline of her from neck to knees, perfectly shapeless under her wrappings, was without any waistline or suggestion of firmness or undulation. Likewise, he remarked the amused flick in her eyes and the compressed line of her two red lips. "How long were you at the mission school?" he inquired. 4 years, she replied. "Are you a Christian?" he asked. The free folk did not submit to baptism, she stated simply, but with rather more of the droning growl between her words. He felt a queer shiver as he watched the scarcely moving lips through which the syllables edged their way. "But you are not veiled," he could not resist saying. "The free folk," she rejoined, "are never veiled." "Then you are not a Mohammedan?" he ventured. "The free folk are not Moslems." "Who are the free folk?" he blurted out incautiously. She shot one baleful glance at him. Waldo remembered that he had to do with an Asiatic. He recalled the three permitted questions. "What is your name?" he inquired. "Amina," she told him. "That is a name from the Arabian Nights," he hazarded. "From the foolish tales of the believers," she sneered. "The free folk know nothing of such follies." The unvarying shutness of her speaking lips, the drawl burr between the syllables, struck him all the more as her lips curled but did not open. "You utter your words in a strange way," he said. "Your language is not mine," she replied. "How is it that you learned my language at the mission school and are not a Christian?" "They teach all at the mission school," she said, "and the maidens of the free folk are like the other maidens they teach, though the free folk, when grown, are not as town dwellers are. Therefore they taught me as any town-bred girl, not knowing me for what I am." "They taught you well," he commented. "I have the gift of tongues," she uttered enigmatically, with an odd note of triumph burring the words through her unmoving lips. Waldo felt a horrid shudder all over him, not only at her uncanny words, but also from mere faintness. "Is it far to your home?" he breathed. "It is there," she said, pointing to the doorway of a large tomb just before them. The wholly open arch admitted them into a fairly spacious interior, cool with the biting temperature of thick masonry. There was no rubbish on the floor. Waldo, relieved to escape the blistering glare outside, seated himself on a block of stone midway between the door and the inner partition wall, resting his gun butt on the floor. For the moment, he was blinded by the change from the insistent brilliance of the desert morning to the blurred gray light of the interior. When his sight cleared, he looked about and remarked opposite the door the ragged hole which laid open the desecrated mausoleum. As his eyes grew accustomed to the dimness, he was so startled that he stood up. It seemed to him that from its four corners the room swarmed with naked children. To his inexperienced conjecture, they seemed about 2 years old, but they moved with the assurance of boys of 8 or 10. "Who are these children?" he exclaimed. "Mine," she said. "All yours?" he protested. "All mine," she replied, a curious, suppressed boisterousness in her demeanor. "But there are 20 of them," he cried. "You count badly in the dark," she told him. "There are fewer." "There certainly are a dozen," he maintained, spinning round as they danced and scampered about. "The free people have large families," she said. "But they are all of one age," Waldo exclaimed, his tongue dry against the roof of his mouth. She laughed, an unpleasant, mocking laugh. Clapping her hands, she was between him and the door when, as most of the light came from it, he could not see her lips. "Is not that like a man? No woman would have made that mistake." Waldo was confused and sat down again. The children circulated around them, chattering, laughing, giggling, snickering, making noise indicative of glee. "Please, get me something cool to drink," said Waldo, and his tongue was not only dry but big in his mouth. "We shall have to drink shortly," she said, "but it will be warm." Waldo began to feel uneasy. The children pranced about him, jabbering strange guttural noises, licking their lips, pointing at him, their eyes fixed on him, with now and then a glance at their mother. "Where is the water?" The woman stood silent, her arms hanging at her sides. It seemed to Waldo she was shorter than she had been. "Where is the water?" he repeated. "Patience, patience," she growled, and came a step nearer to him. The sunlight struck upon her back and made a sort of halo about her hips. She seemed still shorter than before. There was something furtive in her bearing, and the little one sniggered evilly. At that instant, two rifle shots rang out almost as one. The woman fell face downward on the floor. The baby shrieked in a shrill chorus. Then she leapt up from all fours with an explosive suddenness, staggered in a hurled lurching rush towards the hole in the wall, and with a frightful yell, threw up her arms and whirled backward to the ground, doubled and contorted like a dying fish, stiffened, shuddered, and was still. Waldo, his horrified eyes fixed on her face, even in his amazement, noted that her lips did not open. The children, squealing, faint cries of dismay, scrambled through the hole in the inner wall, vanishing into the inky void beyond. The last had hardly gone when the consul appeared in the doorway, his smoking gun in his hand. "Not a second too soon, my boy," he ejaculated. "She was just going to spring." He cocked his gun and prodded the body with the muzzle. "Good and dead," he commented. "What luck. Generally it takes 3 or 4 bullets to finish one. I've known one with 2 bullets through her lung to kill a man." "Did you murder this woman?" Waldo demanded fiercely. "Murder?" the consul snorted. "Murder? Look at that." He knelt down and pulled open the full closed lips, disclosing not human teeth, but small incisors, cusp grinders, wide-spaced and long, keen, overlapping canines, like those of a greyhound, a fierce, deadly, carnivorous dentition, menacing and combative. Waldo felt a qualm, yet the face and form still swayed his horrified sympathy for their humanness. "Do you shoot women because they have long teeth?" Waldo insisted, revolted at the horrid death he had watched. "You are hard to convince," said the consul sternly. "Do you call that a woman?" He stripped the clothing from the carcass. Waldo sickened all over. What he saw was not the front of a woman, but the body of a female animal, old and flaccid, mother of a pack. "What kind of creature is it?" he asked faintly. "A ghoul, my boy," the consul answered solemnly, almost in a whisper. "I thought they did not exist," Waldo babbled. "I thought they were mythical. I thought there were none." "I can very well believe that there are none in Rhode Island," the consul said gravely. "This is in Persia, and Persia is in Asia." And there's your proof by Douglas Newton. "I don't talk merely for effect, even to a fan audience, as you call it," Cumber said in that fat and final way of his. "I mean exactly what I said. I worked out an absolutely undetectable way of murdering a man." Cumber was throwing his weight about as usual. He had not for the first time got onto the front pages of the papers with this absurd lecture of his, and he was not the man to miss any opportunity of a personal boost. His big, luxurious lounge study was emphatically and pointedly littered with all that day's news sheets, scare headlines upward, so that everywhere their eyes turned his guests saw, "Celebrated author invents foolproof murder." Boyington, thin, acrid, brilliant, soured by lack of public recognition, and his nerves jangled by Cumber's display, muttered, "Oh, we've all invented that foolproof crime at one time or other, for purposes of fiction. This is different. This is it. It'll be deadly in fact as well as fiction," Cumber said, filling their glasses with a gesture that said, "You needn't stint yourself. I at least can afford it." Toms, the He-Man novelist, who veiled an utter lack of scruple behind a facade of breezy bigness, laughed. "I noted you were precious careful not to even hint at the detail of your process in your lecture, old boy." "Daren't. I may only be a shocker writer, but I have a sense of responsibility," Cumber said. His self-sufficient solemnity made them all squirm. It was as if he said that being unsuccessful writers made them all crooks. Particularly Thomas looked ugly. But then it was that Cumber had nosed out of one of Tom's dirty pieces of work and held the power of criminal proceedings over his friend. Edwin Mitchell, the Daily Front's crime expert, who was not above hinting in private that Cumber's colossal popularity owed not a little to a sly ability for milking the brains of one Edwin Mitchell sneered. "Of course, that sort of gruff goes down with your West End mob, Cumber, old chap. But we know there's no such thing as that unsolvable crime. You'll back me there, won't you, Inspector?" Inspector Ropes, CID, large, hard, grim, weighed that. He would rather side with Mitchell than with Cumber. Like most men, he detested the bestseller. The man not only used his popularity and wealth to curry favor with the authorities and so make himself a nuisance at the Yard, but Cumber had a nasty habit of employing actual facts he had picked up from the police, and for that reason was an education to crooks, and in Rope's opinion, a public danger. "I think it's harder for a killer to get away with it than it ever has been," he answered slowly. "We've got so much science on our side nowadays. Of course, it's true we can't always get convicting evidence against our man, but we generally know him." "That's what I meant," Mitchell put in. "And if you know your murderer, then his crime is hardly foolproof." "I was thinking of that too," Cumber said pompously. "By a detection-proof murder, I mean one that leaves not a shade of trace. I dwelt expressly on that point in my lecture." He pulled Mitchell's own paper towards him and read in a here's-where-you-get-off voice. "This murder I have invented is absolutely clue-proof in every sense. No police detective or even the fabled Sherlock Holmes could trace it. Doctors and home office experts would be utterly baffled. Neither accident nor chance nor that well-known slip which all criminals are said to make, nor indeed even bad luck, would give the crime away. I know what I am saying, for I am an expert in these things. I assure you, as a matter of definite fact, that this murder I have worked out simply could not be discovered. It is the one perfect crime in history." "And I think you are an utter fool to say such a thing in public," came a voice from the corner, where Pennyfold sat in his shabby and aloof dignity. "I'm of that opinion too," said Tilbury, Cumber's nearest rival in thriller production. "To say a thing like that into a mixed crowd, knowing that the press must broadcast it." "Oh, no risk, I assure you," Cumber smirked. "I'm seeing to that." "The great plan remains hidden in the vast brain," Thomas jeered. "Oh, no, that's not my method," Cumber said, seizing the occasion to show lesser minds how genius worked. "You know, it's a matter of conscience with me that I must be exact in everything. I get the thing down on paper, study all the authorities, then I subject it to tests from every angle, so to speak, before I allow it to pass me." "So, it's on paper now," Boyington said sharply. "Certainly. The whole murder is down in black and white, worked out in scrupulous detail, but naturally, it's filed out of harm's way." He crossed the big lounge to a bookcase, filling one wall. He touched some spring, a whole bay of the shelves, books and all, swung outward. Behind was a smart, bright, and very large safe. It was characteristic of the man that he should indulge in tricks like this. He turned now to catch their appreciation of his dramatic quality. "It's in here, and it will take a pretty good crook to get it out," he boasted. "This safe is one of the latest models, and practically burglar-proof. Naturally, I'm not the sort to be fobbed off with the second best." "There isn't a best," Tilbury put in. "The safe hasn't been made that a good Peterman can't bust. I know that. I've been pretty thoroughly into that subject." "I agree," Mitchell said. "Lamel, the bank breaker, showed me, just before he went up for his last stretch, how any safe could be smashed, no matter what make." "I've heard that story before," Cumber jeered. "It's more than a story. The expert criminal studies each new model as it is issued, often through secret information before it is issued," Pennyfold put in unexpectedly. "I happen to know that. My father was head mechanic to a firm of strong room manufacturers. I myself was apprenticed to the calling before I deserted it for the less stable industry of literature. They were all rather impressed. Pennyfold was the sort of mind one had to respect. That is, all did except Cumber, who never had ears for any voice but his own. It certainly have been to the benefit of others if you hadn't changed your trade," he said with the spitefulness of the contradicted, and as Pennyfold winced and his stern old eyes blazed, the others recalled that Cumber had lent the old man a great deal of money, but Cumber went on contemptuously. "As I say, I've heard that sort of talk before, but I'm afraid my mind isn't satisfied by such simplicity. The facts are against it. Safes are made and bought to keep criminals at bay. And the fact that 9/10 of the safe in the world still keep their valuables intact rather shatters your romantic ideas. All the same, Boynton said, I think your plan for the foolproof murder will be better burnt if it is as perfect as you say. His existence is a public danger. Definitely, Mitchell put in. Who knows what blackguard hasn't already seen it, his great chance of killing someone he hates. Oh, I'm not worrying, Cumber said as he swung the bookcase back into place. I may bum it later, but just now, well, you know how difficult it is for an artist to destroy a perfect bit of work. Inspector Ropes thought him a complacent and dangerous fool. He knew crime too well to feel quite safe. He knew that scores of vile minds might be mulling over Cumber's revelation even now. How many men and women who had nurtured the thought of murder for the hate, greed, revenge, and a dozen other motives must have been stirred by the news that the thing could be done in perfect security, merely through possessing the papers that this fool kept in his flat. It's like having a cylinder of poison gas in your house, the inspector said. It's best destroyed, Mr. Cumber. It's too precious, smirked the novelist. The mere possession of it gives me a glamour with my public. Let's change the subject to poker. But I'll ring you up, Ropes. If one of your pet burglars should get away with it, you'll find the cards and chips in that drawer, Mitchell. There was a curious constraint about the party, and Inspector Ropes, when he left later, felt a sense of anxiety. He considered that pressure really ought to be brought to bear on Cumber to destroy the paper. He meant to talk to the chief constable about it, but was busy for the next 2 days on a receiving case. It was at 1 o'clock the next night that Cumber rang him out of the sleep to say that his burglar-proof safe had been busted and that the formula for the perfect murder, as he called it, had been stolen. Sometime this evening, the novelist shouted over the wire, I've only just got back from Lady Stripe's ball, and I'll swear the safe was intact when I came home to dress at 7. Are you awake, Ropes? Did you hear? I'm telling you, the papers for the foolproof murder have gone. What do you want me to do? Ropes said sulkily. I'm in bed and... But don't you grasp it? Cumber yelped. The danger of it to me! Ropes was taken aback by the real panic in the novelist's voice, if not so much by the me. Cumber would naturally think of himself first, though who'd want to kill a fool like him? But Cumber was wailing. But don't you see? I told the thing to all you chaps, and you! They all hate me. Boynton's never forgiven me for killing the sales of his last masterpiece by my lecture on backboneless fiction. Tom's, I know things about Tom's that could put him in jail, and he knows I know. Mitchell's always had his knife into me because I've beaten him at his own game. Yes, and because he owes me money. Same thing about Pennyfold. He owes me thousands and knows I could blot him out by bankruptcy if I liked. Tilbury, he thinks I'm the Q-man who stands between him and a bestseller status. He's been longing to remove me by fair means or foul for years. They all hate me because I'm such a success, where they aren't because they all owe me money. They pretend to be friends, but I know. You're talking nonsense, Ropes began. I'm not, Cumber almost screamed. I know it was one of them. Of course I know. How? Because it isn't only the details of the foolproof murder that have been stolen. All their IOUs, too, have gone. Yes, the IOUs of all four, and some more besides. That can only be a preliminary to murder. Keep your head, man, Ropes snapped. And if you're not talking rubbish, you're not dead yet. We'll take good care. You can't, Cumber screeched. Not if the murderer has the papers. He can kill me at once without trace. I'm in desperate. Oh. Cumber's voice ended on a wild scream. There was a crashing in Rope's ears as a telephone fell. He hurled into his clothes, dashed by taxi to Cumber's place. He found the flat empty and Cumber dead on the floor. There was nobody there. No sign of violence anywhere. Most baffling case this, said the divisional inspector as he handed in his post-mortem report. Not a trace of how the man died. Not even a hint as to its cause. I hope you have had better luck, Ropes. I've had none at all, the inspector said. There's not even the ghost of a clue. And from the look of it, there never will be. The divisional surgeon stared at him queerly, wondering why he laughed.